It's time now for our ongoing series discussing substance use disorder as a treatable disease, brought to you by the Grays Harbor Consortium.
We have some folks here from the Grays Harbor Consortium, and today we're going to be talking with Danielle and Colleen, and what we're going to be talking about, life circumstances and mitigating factors that contribute to SUD, which is substance use disorders. And I guess they come in all sorts of different ways that this can occur. And so one of the things that can cause issues is people from a multi-generational family with substance use disorder. And so what would you term a family like that? What are some of the symptoms that the family itself has?
Families who have struggled with addiction for years. So mom and dad potentially have had their battles with addiction, and then that leads to kids using as well and continues the cycle of use.
So would this be then, in other words, the parents are using in front of the kids, or the kids find that out on their own and then say, well, if mom and dad can do it, so can I?
Well, there's probably also some genetic factors, and you have genetic factors, you have what's going on around them. Those kinds of things are definitely play a role. And yes, if I'm growing up in a home where I'm seeing mom and dad using, I'm learning that is the way to handle life is through a substance. And I don't think I'm thinking about that as a little kid. It just is. It's like a way of life.
Do you treat the whole family together separately, or how do you deal with a situation like that?
Wouldn't that be wonderful if we could treat the entire family? Yes, that would be optimal. That would be like utopia of treatment if we could treat the entire family. But there's the factor of denial. There's a lot of folks that are not ready to or don't even want to talk about the fact that they have addiction in their family.
So they may say, well, this person in the family's got a problem, but
yeah,
I don't.
Right. Right. If we get that person straightened out, this family would be just fine. They'd be just fine. And yet you have the folks in the family are contributing to that person's disorder by way of like codependency, mm-hmm. enabling. They're hiding that person's. They may say to you, yeah, if we get this person straightened out, our family will be fine. But behind closed doors, there's a lot of hiding and pretending and protecting and fixing, trying to regulate this person's substance use disorder. And sometimes the family gets sicker than even the addict or the alcoholic.
No, why is that? Because they're afraid that that particular person that's addicted, if you take them out of the picture for a period of time, there's going to be a lack of money, a lack of stability, and all sorts of things, or that it'll go away, or it's not that big of a deal.
The idea that someone's trying to fix someone is, yeah, there's fears. Mm-hmm. Fear of losing the person, fear of them dying. And somehow they have adopted this idea that if they just keep trying to fix the situation, that this person will be okay. All the while, that person is being enabled, and they can get further and further down into their addiction.
It's a lot easier to put someone else under a microscope than it is to turn the mirror on yourself.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, what is the classic enabling process? I mean, what are some of the things that people may not even realize is enabling, and other things that's pretty obvious you shouldn't do this?
I would say things like calling into work, calling in sick for them, covering bounce checks for them, not being honest about what's going on with them, like even with close friends and loved ones.
We see a lot with kids that will make excuses for parents' absences. They will fabricate stories sometimes to say why a parent isn't able to be present, you know, regardless of if that's school or sporting events or whatever in their lives. If the kids aren't in that parent's care, it could even be stories about why parents aren't meeting their visitations.
In other words, if they're living in foster care.
Yeah.
Now, what are some of the damage that that does to the children? What are some of the things that happen to them, even if they're not addicted to anything, but their parents are, or a parent? What are the things that go on with them that are dangerous for them mentally?
Abandonment.
Yes. Anxiety disorders.
Yeah.
ADHD can be a contributing factor to ADHD, maybe not like on a physiological level, but on a behavioral level.
Yeah,
you see can't focus.
A lot of behavioral issues, and those can be sometimes learn behaviors because that's how they are able to get attention from a parent who's in addiction.
So what would be a learned behavior of that sort?
You know, we hear a lot about kids, like Colleen was saying, ADHD, behavioral issues in school, acting out. I think sometimes there are other factors going on in that child's life, you know, and that's mm-hmm. how they've learned to get attention from adults who are maybe not functioning in a healthy way. And so when they get to school, that behavior isn't acceptable. And then it causes problems within the education system for them.
So that would be the feeling that the conversation that they would want to have with their parent, they're not having that conversation. So the teacher kind of takes over, or they're just acting out just so an adult pays attention to them. I think that was what I was trying to say.
Yeah. A lot of times you see that with kids.
Yeah.
And so what would be some of the ways they do that when you say acting out?
It's really varied. I think just like the path to addiction is not, there's not one set path. There's not one set way that children express themselves. A lot of times you'll hear that kids don't listen, that they're disruptive, that they're causing harm to other people's possessions or other children. And I think that those can.
So would bullying be one of those ways? They bully kids kind of like their parents bully them, or something similar?
I would say bully, when you're being bullied, that's one of the natural things that's going to happen, is you're going to cope with that by bullying yourself.
Okay. So in other words, I'm getting bullied, so you're going
to
get bullied.
Or they'll even take it out on themselves and do harm to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That's another way to act out.
Now, one of the things, too, is if you have a home that has no emotions, there's another term for that. How would that also kind of enter into the situation the children find themselves in?
Kids don't feel safe in the environment to be able to express themselves. Maybe they've tried and then they were, you know, told things that said things like, you know, I'm going to give you something to cry about if you don't stop crying, or, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
It can cause some emotional dysregulation with kids. And then you become adults. Then those kids become adults and they still don't know how to regulate their emotions and they act out in their relationships.
So how can the schools help, or do they get in touch with you and say, we've got a child here that's acting out and we think that there's something going on at home, but we don't know? Do they contact you, or how does that go when the school is having issues?
Unfortunately, the supports for children in those issues really come from a lot of places. I would say there's not just one direct line you can call and get a child support, unfortunately. A lot of times there's school counselors or professionals within the counseling professionals within the community that they can be referred to. But a lot of that also then has to do with parenting and parents being able to provide their kids with those things that they need. And a lot of times people who are in active addiction cannot provide that consistency to bring kids to counseling appointments. So, you know, I think one of the things that the schools can do is to recognize that not all behavior, and I think our schools do a wonderful job, not all behavior is something that can just magically go away with medication. And I think that, you know, kind of tie into some of the abuse that we see with abuse of medication. Kids are medicated really early sometimes. So
that seems to be the pattern these days.
And so the medication is given to the kids, but it's because the parents have made them need the medication, not just because they're dealing with something internally, but it's what's going on around them that brings that out.
I wouldn't say parents made them. Probably some different context there, but it is an outcome of that mm-hmm. situation at home. Yeah, it's disruptive to the kids to have an active addiction right there in their own home.
Now, what if one spouse sees this going on and knows that there should be something done, but is afraid to say anything to the other spouse who's having the addiction problem? Is that another element to all of this? And that would be enabling, I guess.
Yeah, enabling. Yeah, that's going back to codependency and not knowing what to say or how to say it, or fear of saying anything.
Have you noticed an uptick in these kind of symptoms in kids or families because of the pandemic?
The disease of addiction is an isolating disease. So you already have, if it's in the home, you're already in some form of isolation, emotional, mental, spiritual, physical isolation. And then you add the pandemic to that. That's definitely going to complicate matters.
And so then,
even be a setup for those who are maybe not addicted, who have just maybe been abusing a substance here and there, to have that kick in and become more prevalent.
And so before the pandemic, your parents might not have been in an addiction situation, but then coming through the pandemic, suddenly the family starts changing because of the actions of the parents, and then the kids, they're trying to figure out what the heck's going on because they've never seen this before. Is that something that you see happening where, you know, it starts up in the family that didn't have that problem before?
Well, I think it's like anything, you know, stress, trauma can be a factor in addiction. It typically is the biggest factor in addiction. Mm-hmm. You know, you can think about it just like you may have a friend that you drink with occasionally. You have a beer here or there, but you might notice that they've lost their job and things are not going their way and they're drinking a lot more. I mean, the pandemic is a stressor, just like any other stressors that we face in our life. Unfortunately, everyone is experiencing the same stressor at the same time.
Well, I saw the figures the other day, and I mean, the increase in alcohol use is astronomical compared to how it was before. And when it comes to how kids are handling it, do the boys and girls handle it differently than each other? In other words, a girl might have certain issues that she deals with from it, where the boys might have other emotional issues, but it's caused from the same thing.
I would need to have those statistics right in front of me to speak to those.
Oh, okay. I was just curious because, maybe a girl might handle some of this differently than a boy would when it comes to having the same, living in the same household. Now, it talks about on my list here, history of trauma with prescription medication that led to substance use disorder. So what would be examples of that?
So if you had an individual that has a trauma in their background, in their childhood, that's never been treated, never been looked at, never been touched, that person has, say, an on-the-job injury and gets prescribed a medication, pain pills in particular. Those pain pills may be more of that may become the fix. I mean, here they are, they have an injury.
Okay.
The injury has probably affected how their mobility, how they function on a daily basis, and then that pill comes on board, and that feels magical to a person who has a traumatic background where they weren't allowed to express their emotions. They don't know how to express their emotions. They don't even know they have emotions. And you give them prescription medications, and that'll take off like a wildfire. And then that person comes to a place where maybe the doctor notices that they are abusing that substance. And then they have to be very careful to not continue that, allow them to continue to go down that road. So then they cut them off of the medication. And then you're setting someone up who has an injury, whose mobility has been affected, their life has been affected, their job probably has been affected, and that person is going to be seeking that thing that made them feel better. And it's just a setup. It really can be.
And of course, then if it's an opioid addiction, then when they get to a certain point, they're going to have to go through the withdrawal symptoms, which I guess can be very tough for people.
Yeah, very tough.
My understanding, too, in fact, I think there was a story that we had about a young man who took half a pill that looked like something it wasn't. It was fentanyl. And they took, you know, half this pill, and they had to be given the antidote, I think.
Narcan.
Narcan. Mm-hmm. Two or three separate times to finally, you know, get him through this. And so is that another big issue where you've got things that are supposed to be an opioid but not fentanyl, and then people are around that, or you've got kids that, like this young man that was having issues with it? How do you treat those people, and what are your solutions for that?
You know, it's always good to have people get assessed and have them really look at what happened there. Was that a one-time thing? We're seeing some methamphetamine screens come back with morphine or fentanyl in them. That's something that's being produced by the folks that are putting those drugs together.
So an upper and a downer combined.
It's very common right now. People who are using heroin are also using methamphetamines.
So physically, what is the, I mean, that's an up and a downer. Your body doesn't know what the heck to do.
Probably hoping to just be at an even kill, I suppose. But it could be a, it can be a death.
I speak to a lot of women who share their story and share their use history with me. And a lot of times they will say, I started taking opioids, you know, they maybe started taking pills, moved on to heroin, but they weren't liking how slow they were feeling. They felt they had other things happen in their lives, like children or things like that. And so they started to try to regulate. But trying to come off of heroin or other opioids is really, really difficult. And so it was easier to add another substance to try to help them regulate.
So when a family suffers from things like this, where do you guys take over? Is if they have regular insurance and that sort of thing, they go one direction. If they're are in need of a safety net, they come to you. What how do you get involved in this?
So the consortium is actually made up of a variety of providers. My program is the Parent-Child Assistance Program. We work with moms who have experienced substance use disorder during pregnancy. And Colleen's agency provides a variety of services, including substance use disorder treatments. So really, we're all an entry point for someone. You know, for me, I get referrals from all across the county. Sometimes, you know, unfortunately, parents get to a point in their use where they're not able to care for their children. They end up working with DCYF or CPS. And I'll get a referral just saying, this mom said that she used during pregnancy, and we talk to her, and then we're the opening point. Then I can hand off to Colleen. We're just a group of people all with different jobs, truly, with the goal of, you know, ending substance use disorder, helping people get well, and also ending the stigma, because, you know, we talked about there's not one path to substance use disorder. It's varied, but a lot of it has to do with trauma, and a lot of it has to do with resiliency and building resiliency in people. I would say there's not many people who haven't experienced a trauma, but not all people are substance using.
Join us next Monday morning at 8:40 a.m. for our continuing discussion on substance use disorder as a treatable disease, brought to you by the Grays Harbor Consortium, exclusively on 103.5 FM and 1450 a.m. KBKW. To hear archived discussions, log on to gograysharbor.com.